You're tuned into KPFA Radio. I'm Tara Darabji, joined in studio by Salman Rushdie on book tour for his memoir, Joseph Anton. Salman Rushdie is the author of 11 novels, including Midnight's Children, for which he won a Booker Prize and the Best of the Bookers. After reading his memoir, I also know Salman Rushdie is the proud father of two sons, was kissed by Hugh Grant on camera, meditated with Allen Ginsberg, and not only wrote lyrics to a U2 song, but is friends with Bono. His novel, The Satanic Verses, was met by violent opposition that caused him to go into hiding when the Iranian Ayatollah Khomeini issued a death order for Salman Rushdie, known as a fatwa. The novel of The Satanic Verses found itself in the middle of a battleground of religion, secularism, violence, and freedom of speech. Publishing houses and bookstores were bombed. A translator of The Satanic Verses was stabbed. Another was murdered in Japan. And one of the publishers lived through an attempted assassination that left his body full of bullets. During this time, Salman Rushdie, the author, disappeared, and Joseph Anton was born. We are joined in studio by Salman Rushdie to speak about his memoir, Joseph Anton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I'm sure it's been a wild whirlwind of a tour.
Yeah, well, book, you know what book tours are like. They're nonstop.
Well, hope to have one day, but right now let's talk about this incredible memoir. And I have to say, you know, it's a journey into the inner world of the government security protection. There's tons of incredible, unbelievable things, from spies to assassin. It's a real life thriller, but it also goes deeper. It delves into your process as a writer and your inner world.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted it to be a full, you know, a proper self-portrait, you know, and not just a self-portrait, but in a way, a portrait of the world that I've lived through, you know, not just through the moment of the fatwa, but wider, more broadly than that. You know, I mean, one of the things that I really was happy to do in the book was to make a portrait of my parents, for instance. You know, and I mean, particularly about the sometimes very difficult, but also very close relationship between me and my father, you know, from which a lot of my ideas came. So I wanted it to be, like a three-dimensional portrait.
And it was, and I think you definitely captured the intimacy of family. I think the relationship that struck me the most was definitely your relationship with your sister.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're very close. You know, I mean, she's a year younger than me. She claims to be a lot younger than that.
Don't out her. We're on radio. You don't need to give away a woman's age.
Yeah, well, you know, it's too late now. But we've always been very, very intimately close. I mean, as we're not quite twins, but it's almost as if we were. And that's been the case from when we were little children to now. And she's super intelligent, and she's also very outspoken. So you don't get away with anything with her.
Yeah, and it showed. And, you know, she held you accountable. And it was like when your sister called and was like, what are you doing, compromising and selling yourself out? You knew to hang your head at that point.
Yeah. You can't mess around with her, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Well, I have to say, I got to page 600 of your memoir, and I took a pause, and then I suddenly realized, I mean, here you are, you're a genius fiction writer, and you're writing this true life story, but you're able to do it about a fictional man. The narrator himself is Joseph Anton, essentially, and so you actually bring together and tell a true story through someone who was created, and like so many of your fictitious characters, Joseph Anton had an auspicious birthday. Though he was not named at the time, he was born on Valentine's Day 1989, the day the fatwa was issued. Tell us about that day.
Well, I just got a phone call from the radio journalist telling me about this this very worrying threat or death order or whatever you want to call it from the Ayatollah Khomeini. And at first, we just didn't know how seriously to take it. We didn't know if this was just rhetorical fist shaking, you know, or if it was a real threat. Some of the journalists I talked to that day were telling me not to take it too seriously, you know, because it seemed so outrageous that in a way people thought it couldn't be true. And unfortunately, within less than 24 hours, really, it was quite clear. I mean, I was being told by the British police that they were taking it very seriously, and they thought it was very dangerous, and so it was.
And at that time, you thought it would just be a few days.
Yeah, everybody thought that. And it's because...
I mean, it's absurd. I mean, entirely absurd. The book had been published for several months already.
6 months or so, yeah.
Yeah, and you're getting some criticism. You're kind of riding that wave of...
Well, I think it's okay for books to start arguments, you know.
I think, at an intellectual level.
But. Yeah, I think it's one of the things that books often usefully do, is that they make a culture look at itself and debate itself and so on. And I think that's sort of what was happening. And I was taking part in that. You know, I was going on radio and television and writing articles and so on and arguing my case against people who disagreed. And I thought that was all kind of almost healthy. You know?
Absolutely.
And then came the Khomeini fatwa, and that sort of changed the subject, because instead of being an argument about ideas, it became a question of terrorism, you know, and really the narrative changed at that point.
Absolutely. And let's talk a little bit about when you were asked to take on a new identity and the naming of Joseph Anton. I know the security forces said it was probably better not to make it sound too Indian.
Yeah.
I mean, they essentially, they anglicized you.
Yeah, they forced this sort of deracinated name, you know. I mean, I chose the name, but they said don't make it an Indian name. Because
well, you tried others first.
I did. Yeah, I did try all kinds of things, which were all kind of variously crappy, really. But
too difficult to pronounce. I mean,
so, I know, because they were Indian, you see, and these were not Indian policemen, of course. And so they found it too hard. They wanted something simple, and so in the end, I thought, well, I'll just retreat into literature, and ended up picking these names, the two first names of Conrad and Chekhov. And then they turned that into a diminutive. So instead of being Joseph Anton, they turned it into Joe, which I really hated.
Joe, what's really up, Joe?
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
I know. And the reason I made it the title of the book was just because I thought it, because I always hated having that name, you know. And I was really delighted some years later when I was finally able to, you know, give it up and not use it anymore. And I thought if I make the title of the book, it's just a way of showing people how weird that time was, you know, to be asked to give up your name and to be asked to give up the race of your name as well.
Well, I find it really symbolic because I think it's I mean, yours is a story of immigration. And like you say, I mean, it takes these crazy twists. It becomes this super thriller, this spy story. It goes in these directions that are fantastical and unbelievable, but true. Yeah. But fundamentally, it's the same story that so many immigrants face. They come to the West and their name is changed. Their name is changed in the
Ellis
name.
Island, yeah.
Exactly, because it's not pronounceable. It's too ethnic. They want to blend in, all of those things. And it happened to you, but under these completely, you know.
A bizarre situation. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's right. But when the person who became famous as Sam Goldwyn first came to America, he was given the name at Ellis Island of Sam Goldfish. and he had to change that later on, otherwise we would have Metro Goldfish Mayer. You know, but it's true that many of us who've come from one world into another face this kind of issue just socially. You know, I mean, obviously I had this extra dimension of being flung into a kind of spy novel. And I mean, in retrospect, of course, you know, it was quite clear to me that it's a great story to tell, but it wasn't a great story to live through.
Absolutely not. I think there's a Chinese proverb. It's considered a curse to say, may you live in interesting times.
Yeah, well, that's what I developed, you know, most writers do not have interesting lives.
That's the thing. I equate the same thing for a writer to say, may you have lots of material.
Yeah, well, the problem is, you know, writing is a sort of disease. And even when you're going through the worst of times, there's a little voice whispering in your ear saying, good story, you know, write it down. Yeah. And so I did keep a journal. And in a way, keeping the journal was a sort of act of optimism, because it was a way of telling myself that one day it would end and I'd be able to write about it. And a lot of the time it was hard to believe that that day would come, you know, and whether I would be ever the one writing about it, because there could have been a horrible ending, you know, and then somebody else would have that job.
Yeah, and there's a sort of, I mean, that's one of the themes that runs through your memoir. And as you're talking about it, you know, you, Salman Rushdie, have this death threat on your shoulders that's very, I mean, it was a level two. So you were essentially second to the Queen.
Yeah, me and the Queen and the Prime Minister.
Yeah.
But actually, in many ways, the Scotland Yard believed that this was the most dangerous protection that they had undertaken. And so even though it was all, level one basically means there's somebody outside the room shooting at you. So nobody's at level one. you know. But level two is as high as it gets. And yes, it's people like the Prime Minister and the Queen. But this operation was codenamed Operation Malachite. I never knew why.
It's a beautiful stone.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know.
It's sort of poetic. Write a poem about it.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, I didn't choose that name. That somebody in Scotland Yard had that moment of poetry. Yeah.
Right.
But anyway, this operation was thought to be, it was so dangerous in their view that they told their protection officers that you know, normally they would just allocate protection officers to various protections. Say, you look after him, you look after her, you know, whatever. In this case, they said they wouldn't order people to go. It would have to be, everybody would have to volunteer. So, I mean, it's a very courageous thing that for 10 years, people, you know, worked on what they believed to be the most dangerous of the protections, and they were all volunteers.
There is, I think, a level of optimism. I know that it was, I mean, the darkness, the danger, the fear, the terror, and also the oppression that you went through really comes through in the memoir. But in addition to that, there's also this resilience and this, you're going to keep on living. And I mean, you said that your second son was actually the first child to be born into this.
Yes, they called him the special branch officers. They called him the special branch baby, because you know, most of the people they protect, like politicians and members and the Queen, are obviously older, and their children would be grown up, you know, so they're not really at a moment when they're having new babies, and we were.
What was that like? What was that like to bring? I mean, I you know, your wife at the time didn't she labor in Princess Diana's the same room,
or,
you know, all of that. But beyond that sort of,
yeah, that was just coincidence, you know. And when your time comes, they give you the room that's empty. You know, it's not a question of booking Princess Diana's room. It just we only found out afterwards that that's what it was. But
emotionally,
it was an act of optimism to have a child, because I was very worried about it. You know, I thought, how do you bring up a child in this situation? You know, how does he go to school? How does he have his friends over? You know, when does he have to start lying about where his father lives, etc.? You know, and I just thought it's going to be a nightmare. How do you do this? But then we wanted to have a child, and we just thought, you know, it's a way of saying this is going to end. And wonderfully, that's what happened. So that really, I mean, my older son, Zafar, was 9 when the trouble began, and he was more or less just about 21 when it ended. So he had to grow up through it, and also had the terrible tragedy during that time that his mother passed away. You know, the parent who was supposed to be safe and looking after him passed away of cancer, and so he was very much, you know, he grew up through this. He was very much in the thick of it. And Milan, fortunately, my younger son, really has just about no memory of it, you know, because it ended when he was very, very little. He claims to have a vague memory of sitting in the back seat of a car with me in a baby seat, being driven by people who he used to call the drivers, and who were in fact, of course, police officers. But that's the only memory he's got. So really, he's been able to grow up free of this. And that's great. It was what we'd hoped, and it's what happened.
And Salman Rushdie, your memoir really goes into, you have a whole chapter called The Trap of Wanting to be Loved. Mm. And what was really interesting to me about this is you talk about it both in your personal life, that urge, and then also in your public life with the battle over your book, The Satanic Verses. And what did your journey as Joseph Anton teach you about love?
Well, it's be less needy, I guess, you know, I think, you know, but...
Break that down, less needy, what do you mean?
Well, I mean that it can lead you into traps, you know. There was a moment where I really managed to, I somehow got into the cast of mind that I could talk my way out of this, you know, that I could just explain myself to people. I could say to people, look, you know, you got it wrong. You've made a misunderstanding, or you've been told the wrong things about me, you know. Sometimes felt like that. The character, the famous first line of Kafka's novel, The Trial, which is someone had been telling lies about Joseph K. You know, and I thought, well, somebody's been telling lies about me. But if I can just tell the truth and say, look, here's what I thought I was doing. It's not a bad thing to do. And the book is not a bad book. You know, if you read it without all those preconceptions, you'll see that. And now that I've explained it, we can be friends, you know, et cetera. And I mean, it's a ridiculous piece of self-deception that I thought I could get into that. And get out of the jam, you know, in that way. And so it led me into some very difficult and wrong compromises with Islamic figures who I shouldn't have made those compromises with. What they taught me was to be stronger in my self-belief, you know, not try and just please people, you know, and just to understand that there were going to be people who didn't like what I did. It's going to be the case. And to tell you the truth, I don't like them much either, you know, and so that's okay.
Well, I think that's sort of a fundamental truth in life. When you get to a place where you understand that you're going to do what you're going to do and you don't need to be liked for it, but that you represent a truth and not compromising on that has a certain freedom.
It does. I think it really clarified a number of things for me. And after that, I think life has been, I mean, it may not have been easy, but at least I knew what I was doing and where I was going and why. You know, it also, I mean, for instance, when you write books, you know, it's better to have good reviews than bad reviews, no question. You know, you want people to like what you do, and it's a bit sad when they don't. But when you know the direction you're going on as a writer, you know, you've thought about it and you think, I want to go this way and I want to do these things. I mean, you hope that people will come along with you, you know, and find that an interesting direction. But if they don't, I mean, you're still going that way. You know, my view is that still, I'm sorry you can't come along, but this is still the way I'm going. And it's that kind of, that is a sort of liberation, you know, once you can think about your life like that.
It is. And that sort of kind of, I think what illustrated that for me again in your memoirs when Fury came out. And it was, you know, it was before you were called a prophet and the Twin Towers came blazing down and it came out in the UK and it was heavily criticized to the point of rejection. And you talk about being able to almost embrace the rejection. Yeah. And,
you know, I discovered I didn't care.
Yeah.
It's a very interesting thing to discover. Because I felt very strongly that it was a book that I was happy with, you know, and at that moment, I mean, everybody, you know, it happens to everybody because literature is subject to fashion like everything else. And there's a moment when you're like, you know, the new kid on the block or you're the hottest ticket in town. And there's another moment when people are looking for something different, you know, and they turn away from the voice they feel they've heard too much or whatever it is, you know, just happens. And it happens to everybody. It happened to Shakespeare, you know, so it could happen to, it really does happen to everyone. And I discovered that I really, truthfully didn't care. And I thought this book is strong enough, it'll make its way. And it's very interesting to me now, you know, I do a little bit of like college lecturing in America. And I discovered that the two books of mine that kids all read, you know, are Fury and The Ground Beneath Her Feet. I mean, those are the books that they go to first. And so I think, well, that's all right. You know, it's found its way. In the end, a book has to find its own way. You can't help it.
And then Salman Rushdie, your memoir, Joseph Anton, is filled with really profound real-life metaphors. And one of the scenes I wanted to talk about was when you were just starting to break free of the British security shackles and making, you know, just on the cusp of making the decision to come and live in America. And at that same time, you met your fourth wife to be, Padma, at the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
So it's kind of amazing, you
it
know.
Is, it was, you know, in fact, as I say in the book, if you put that in a novel, people would say it was corny.
No,
it would
get cut out. Yeah. You'd be like, come on, give us a metaphor more real.
Exactly.
This is, they'd be cliche, but.
Yeah, but it just happens to be true.
Life cliched you.
Yeah, it was a launch event for a magazine called Talk, which actually didn't survive very long. I mean, it only lasted 2 or 3 years. And it was a very grand event on Liberty Island with huge firework displays and everybody you've ever heard of there. And that's why I ran into her right under the Statue of Liberty. And she seemed like, you know, Indian version of the Statue of Liberty come to life.
As, you know, I read your memoir, it was a really amazing read for me as a writer because it let me into your process, your intentions, your failures. And there was a time before you wrote Midnight's Children, and you were talking about how that time you were sort of characterizing as a failure. And you said in your memoir, if you hadn't become the writer you thought you had in you to be, it was because you didn't know who you were. Mm-hmm. And the next paragraph started with, that you were a migrant. And so how is a writer's own self-understanding really pivotal for what the writer is able to put on the page?
Well, I mean, the thing that I felt was that writers I was living in London at the time, writers around me who had just been born and raised in England, they had a sort of simpler understanding of their identity. You know, they just came from that place and grew up there in that community, and they just it wasn't in question their identity. You know, it was what it was, and I think it gave them a platform, you know, a springboard, if you like, from which they could launch off into whatever direction they wanted to go. And I'm talking about this unusually gifted generation, of which I was a part of, you know, people like Ian McEwan and Julian Barnes and Martin Amis and Kazuo Ishiguro, Carol Phillips and Angela Carter and Jeanette Winterson and, you know, many, many others. I mean, it was a really extraordinary time in British literature. I felt at that moment kind of confused about self, you know, because I'd grown up in India. My parents at a later point, like when I was 17 or so, had mysteriously migrated to Pakistan and kind of hated it, and so did I. Meanwhile, I was trying to make a life in England, and I think they just, to use the title of my own novel, I didn't feel that I had solid ground beneath my feet, you know, and mm-hmm. and so I was kind of spinning my wheels, you know, and I needed to answer some questions for myself about that before I could find a real direction, you know, and Midnight's Children came out of that. One of the things I was worrying about was that I'd been by then not living in India for a while, and I was worrying about losing my connection to it, you know, which I hated the idea of, you know. So I wrote that book really as an act of reclaiming that heritage, you know, and that self, it seemed to work.
Did you feel it was sort of, was there a battle of sort of internalized racism along that path for you?
Don't know. I can't remember really. I don't know. I mean, I think there was, I mean, I like everyone else who's from a different race in England. I mean, I have some stories to tell, you know, about racial trouble, you know, and I mean, they're so commonplace that in a way it's not worth telling them, because in the end I didn't want to allow that stuff to define me. You know, I just needed to find out for myself who I thought I was and go from that place. And I mean, Midnight's Children was a big gamble because really my writing hadn't been successful up to that point. And it was a kind of everything or bust kind of move, you know. And when I finished it, I thought it was a good book, you know. But then, as I say, I had no track record at all. And I thought, if other people don't think this is a good book, then I probably don't know what a good book is and I should probably stop. But fortunately, that's not what happened.
And there was another piece of writing advice that I thought was really interesting, Salman Rushdie. And can you tell us about how Arthur Hibbert's advice on writing history is a guiding principle for your fiction writing?
Yeah, well, Arthur Hibbert was a brilliant history professor at Cambridge, who was my supervisor for a while. And he told me this thing, which I never forgot. He said, you should never write history until you can hear the people speak. You know, meaning that if you don't know how they speak, you don't know enough about them, and you're not ready to tell their story. And he was talking about history, and it's good advice for the writing of history, but I thought it was also very good advice for the writing of fiction, because, you know, when you know how people speak, you begin to understand who they are. You know, are they talkative or not talkative? Do they say smart things or dumb things? You know, do they use bad language or not? What's their vocabulary? You know, do they have an accent, etc. There's a whole number of questions you have to ask about a fictional character. And when you've answered those and you know how the character speaks, you know a lot about the character already. You know, so it's very good advice, and I've always tried to follow it. And this year, one of the great pleasures of this year is that I discovered that this old professor of mine was still alive. I really didn't know that. I mean, he's now in his 90s, and I was able to go meet him. And I was able to tell him, you know how it is, you have these great teachers in your life, if you're lucky, and they just say that something like that. They say one or two things that just stick with you forever. And it's usually you don't have a chance, or many times you don't have a chance to tell them what they taught you, you know. And I'd had that chance. So I was able to meet with him and say, look, you said this to me, and it's really helped me all my life. And he said, oh, yes, yes, I remember that thought, you know. And it was just, it was a very great moment to have been able to close that circle.
Where were you able to meet with him?
Well, he was living, he was, you know, he had been a history don at Cambridge. He was no longer connected to the university, but he was still living in a tiny little house in the city of Cambridge. So I went up to see him there.
Salman Rushdie, your memoir closes essentially on March 27th, 2002, when the British security force lift your threat level and Joseph Anton disappears.
Yeah. Good news.
Absolutely. And you were, you know, you were persecuted by the government of Iran and many other extremist Islamic groups around the world. And in your memoir, in many senses, the U.S. is a place that you sought and received refuge.
Mm-hmm.
However, post 9/11 in the U.S., there continues to be a huge backlash against Muslims, South Asians, brown people, from hate crimes to surveillance to murders. And how do you grapple with the complexity of this?
Well, I mean, you have to, you know, you have to speak out against injustice, whatever, of whatever form it takes. You know, it's a that's an unending process. You know, and you know, yesterday's aggressors can be tomorrow's victims. I mean, that's also true. I mean, my view is that I'm not a religious person, so I have very little interest in defending religion. You know, I mean, I'm sort of closer to the Hitchens position than anything else on that. But clearly you have to defend people, you know, for people to be discriminated against, attacked, or et cetera, you know, subjected to the things that you mentioned, is very wrong. And it needs to, for instance, when there was this ridiculous fuss in New York City about a mosque / community center being started in the, not, you know, a couple of, some distance from Ground Zero. And there was a kind of ridiculous fuss about it. I mean, I spoke up in support of that project. I mean, for instance, I mean, there's certain obvious facts, which is there already are mosques in that area, you know. So and then how far does it have to be before it's okay? You know, if half a mile is not okay, is three quarters of a mile okay? Is a mile okay? You know, it's a sort of ludicrous question. And I was reminding people, for example, that in the aftermath of the 9/11 attack, there actually had been Muslim religious services carried out at Ground Zero, because there, after all, had been a lot of Muslims who died in the Trade Towers. And nobody minded that there was a Muslim religious service actually on the site. So then it becomes ludicrous to say you can't have one half a mile away. You know, so yes, I mean, you try and, I mean, I've certainly tried to be reasonable about this. You know, I've tried to be a voice of reason, if you like, whenever possible.
And we just have a few minutes left, but one of the questions I really wanted to ask you was, I notice a lot of your books, there's a deep connection with Kashmir in it, from mm-hmm. Midnight's Children mm-hmm. to, you know, Shalimar the Clown, when we really delve into it. And I know your grandparents are, you know, come from there as well, but
yeah.
Why do you feel sort of a need to write about Kashmir?
Well, you know how it is. If you're from, when you're Indian, you connect to region more than nation, really. People say I'm Punjabi, I'm Bengali, I'm Tamil, you know. And in that sense, our family was Kashmiri, and so it's always been important to all of us. You know, that's where we came from. And the fact that we settled elsewhere in India, I mean, that's not an unusual story. But we used to go all the time as kids, you know, and I've been many times. I've made a documentary about Kashmir. I've done a number of things. And it's clear that you've got people there caught between a rock and a hard place. You know, you've got the Indian government has been, to say the least, authoritarian, you know, and often worse than that. There have been ridiculous amounts of abuses, you know, killings, rapes, you know, dreadful things.
Disappearances,
yeah. And on the other side, there's a kind of jihadist attack on Kashmiri people coming across the border from Pakistan. And what Kashmiris have always said when asked is leave us, you know, would you please both leave us alone? You know, Kashmir for the Kashmiris is being the constant slogan. And that's the thing nobody pays any attention to. So, yeah, I mean, I always knew it was a subject I was going to have to deal with, and so one of these days. And that's why, I mean, Shalimar the Clown is, I mean, it's a dark novel, you know, it's a kind of tragic novel, but I think it's one of the books that I'm most proud of because it managed to take on that story.
It was beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, in our last minute, the whole memoir, your memoir, Joseph Anton, deals with the quest essentially for freedom. And now that Joseph Anton has disappeared, Salman Rushdie, are you free now?
Oh, I feel okay, thank you. Yeah, no, it's been, I mean, really, it's been, fortunately, I mean, for a long time, I would imagine being out the other end of the tunnel, you know, and sometimes I found it difficult to imagine how that would happen. But it did happen, and it happened now, you know, as you say, the book ends more than 10 years ago. And those last 10 years really have been pretty much back to normal. And I mean, to say the least, it's a great relief, but it also gave me the peace of mind, the tranquility to look back at that time and write about it from that, from this moment of greater tranquility. Because I wanted to be, when I wrote this story, I always told myself, write it when you're in control of the material, not when the material is in control of you. You know, and I waited until I felt in that place, and that's why the book comes out now.
Well, congratulations. Joseph Anton is an amazing feat, and you survived it, made it through, and made it through with more beauty and grace.
Thank you so much.
Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for joining us on KPFA.